Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hey, everybody. It is almost the end of August, if you can believe it. And my goal is to convince more than 30 of you to sign up for Lyft using my promo code BACKSEATRIDER, all one word. I would appreciate it so much if you guys did this. Last month in July, 27 people did that, and those 27 people are now enjoying $5 off each of their first 10 rides on Lyft, and they have also helped support this podcast. So for those of you who haven't signed up for Lyft yet, please do so and just punch in the code BACKSEATRIDER, all one word, into the payment tab to support the show. But just so you know, Lyft is not a sponsor of Backseat Rider, doesn't have anything to do with the conversations that you are about to hear in this podcast. Again, the code is Backseat Rider, and it is good for $50 in ride credit for any new users of the Lyft app.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com presentation.
Most of the passengers I drive have jobs that are quote-unquote normal. Office manager, salesperson, consultant, hairstylist, waiter, stuff like that. But this week, a theme emerged without my doing. Normally, I'm the one who picks the theme or the topic, and this one, this week, kind of picked itself on its own. And that is because I picked up three different passengers on three different days with three different jobs, but they all had one thing in common. And that is that they were all extreme, not normal at all. In fact, terrifying in many respects. One of them does his job in the air.
It's pretty crazy. I myself didn't believe it until I actually saw it. It's pretty crazy.
The second one on land.
My first week when I started, I had two gunshot wounds to the head.
And the third one by sea.
So you can feel this amazing, even the fear, yeah, it's amazing, the fear on big waves.
This week you will hear stories from all three. Hello everybody and welcome to another episode of Backseat Rider, the podcast where I drive a Lyft and whoever ends up in the backseat of my car becomes the cast of this show. And we start with a 35-year-old guy. I picked him up in University Village, which is just southwest of downtown. Now, with the Lyft app, as soon as you indicate that you've arrived at the pickup location, a profile picture of the rider pops up on your phone. And in this guy's picture, he was standing right in front of a helicopter. And when he hopped in a few minutes later into the backseat, I noticed that there was a helicopter on his shirt. So turns out, sure enough, he is a helicopter pilot.
How difficult is it?
Well, it's like anything else in life. It's challenging, especially in the beginning. It just takes a lot of work. You just go to a school like you would for any kind of trade or anything that you're learning how to do. There are multiple control mechanisms to operate the helicopter. Some that are unique to a helicopter versus flying, let's say, like a fixed-wing aircraft, like an airplane or something like that. So in the beginning, especially, it is challenging. People say it's like trying to ride a unicycle, juggle with fire, and try to jump through a hoop. So it is pretty challenging, and especially in the beginning. So,
what was your first flight like? What was going through your mind during the first flight you did solo?
My first solo flight, that's kind of a rite of passage for every pilot, your first solo, because that's the first time that you're actually in the aircraft, kind of without that security blanket of your instructor with you. So it's very rewarding, but very nerve-wracking. My instructor had a GoPro, and so he turned it on right before he got out. He was like, okay, I think this is it. I think you're ready to go. And I just turned white, he said. He's like, I was just, you know, because nervous, very nervous to do it. But very cool, a lot of fun. I'm actually from Texas originally, and I did my first solo at the Alliance Airport.
From where to where did you go on your first solo?
Is just within the confines of the airport. Your first cross-country would be like going to multiple airports. So the first solo is just essentially a couple, like, think of it as like a racetrack around the airport. Like I said, it was an Alliance Airport in Texas. It's a busy airport. American Airlines has one of their repair centers there. And I remember calling up the tower, letting them know I was a student pilot, taking off, taxiing out, and as soon as I was getting ready to take off, they told me to hold short of the runway, and two Air Force T-38s came in right in front of me and landed. And I just remember thinking how cool this was. I'm in a helicopter. There's jets passing over. So
awesome.
It was really neat. And then went up and did my, you know, couple patterns, flew around. It was exhilarating. Really cool feeling to be, you know, flying by yourself with no one there to do it. So it's very liberating. A lot of fun.
In what capacity are you a pilot now? Do you fly an emergency helicopter now, like patients or what?
No, currently I'm flying for a company here in Chicago called Rotorzen Helicopters. We operate three R-44 helicopters and one 206, and we do sightseeing tours around Chicago, and we also do flight instruction and photo flights.
Really?
Yeah, and we're based out of the Chicago Vertiport. It's the largest helicopter port in America.
So are you a docent as well? Are you giving the tour and flying, or is there someone else that's...
No, the pilot actually handles all that responsibility, so they're responsible for flying the aircraft, providing a personalized tour through the city of Chicago. We've got a 15-minute and a 30-minute tour, or our basic and our extended tour, and we take you around the city of Chicago. We just kind of narrate, kind of like the architecture tours that are offered over at Navy Pier, just from an aerial perspective.
So what's the craziest thing that's ever happened to you as a pilot?
So my previous job, I used to be, I worked for a aerial SAW company. So I used to fly, or I was a training pilot for a company that they were training me how to be cut down trees with about a 1,000-pound chainsaw underneath the helicopter along the power lines. So it's called aerial tree trim, and if you like look it up on YouTube or Google it, you should be able to find some videos. It's pretty crazy. I myself didn't believe it until I actually saw it. It's pretty crazy.
I went home and I YouTubed aerial saw, and he was absolutely right. They're giant chainsaws. They're more than 20 feet long, this huge row of circular blades that hang below the chopper.
So yeah, the chainsaw hangs about 100, 120 feet below the helicopter, and it's connected to like a four-stroke engine. And it's got a 10, 22-inch titanium tip blades, and you just drag those through the trees. And it just creates, you know, if you look down a corridor, like where the power lines are, and you can see, you know, obviously there's going to be growth, and that's what you want to prevent. And so if you look down one that's just been cut, it looks perfect, like just like a box shape. So that's how a lot of times that they do it.
Pilots like him not only have to fly the helicopter, but they have to precisely operate the saw as well, so it trims the trees around the power lines without messing up the power lines themselves. That'd be a disaster. So margin of error of basically zero. But he says that one aerial saw can do in one day what it would take a tree trimming crew on the ground an entire week to do.
That sounds insane.
Yeah, it was one of the most craziest things I've ever done. Very nerve-wracking. The pilots are excellent. They're just a master of the aircraft and what they can do with the machine. It's essentially an extension of themselves. But it takes a lot of hard work and concentration because, like I said, you've got a saw going. You're flying by yourself. You're leaning out, looking down at the saw, and cutting along the power line. So it's one of the most dangerous things you can do. I think it's one of the most dangerous jobs there is.
How long did you do it?
I did it for about a year and a half. And
live to tell about it.
Live to tell, yeah. I got some really great experience with a really great group of individuals and extremely talented pilots. And then my first solo flying with the saw was pretty intense for me. So just picking up and setting on the saw and taking it around the airport and actually lowering it into the trees and doing some cutting was one of the most craziest things I've ever done. So
he doesn't have any kids, but he does have a wife. And although his aerial saw days are now behind him, he's still getting up in a chopper every single day. And Chicago is no joke when it comes to the weather.
Risk is relative. You know, we all take risk when we get into the car and drive. You know, we just try to do what we can. I'm a very safety-focused individual, and so is the company that I work for. So we are flying people's families and brothers and sisters and parents and stuff. And so I take that responsibility very seriously. You know, you train very hard when you're learning how to do this position, and, you know, you train for emergencies. And so you do the best that you can and hope for the best and, you know, let your training kick in if, you know, God forbid anything decides to happen. So, but, you know, I'm very passionate about it. I'm 35. I've been flying for about 4 years. I was an IT guy before that. So, you know, to people who say that, you know, dreams can't come true, you just got to work hard at it. Blood, sweat, and tears. It's taken me a long time to get where I am, and I'm still working very hard, working multiple jobs and flying and all that kind of stuff. So anybody can make their dreams come true. You just got to work hard.
And so what's an example of a shift you'll work? Is this a
six to four. If it gets busy, sometimes it's six to seven. So it all depends on what comes in.
Those are overnight shifts she is talking about, 6 p.m. to 7 a.m. And when she says it all depends on what comes in, she is talking about trauma patients. This is a 29-year-old ER doctor. She's in her residency and works at a number of different hospitals throughout Chicago. And on this particular day, I picked her up in Andersonville to take her to a hospital on the north side for yet another overnight shift in the emergency room. And like the chopper pilot, she was dressed in work clothes as well, which meant full medical scrubs.
Every night it's something different. Mm-hmm. I mean, my first week when I started, I had 2 gunshot wounds to the head. And my supervising attending was like, go ahead and just intubate the patient and stabilize them. And I was like, I'm new at this, you know.
What does intubate mean?
So I like put a tube down their throat and to help them breathe. So I mean, it was like day 4 or 5. Yeah.
And how'd you handle it when your attending said that?
I'm pretty cool and calm on the outside, so I think everybody thought I was pretty chill, but I was like screaming on the inside, like, oh my god, I don't know what to do. Like, I mean, I knew what to do. It's in there somewhere. It's just retrieving that information. And, you know, like on day 5, you're just so overwhelmed with everything. So it was kind of crazy. Yeah.
Right. So where was this person shot? You said 2 to the head, like...
Yeah, like from one side of the, like, temple out the other side. Yeah.
And they
were alive when they came in, so... But they didn't make it.
They didn't make
it. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And how does that... How do you handle that emotionally? I mean, that's day 5.
Yeah.
Just in this, and, you know, that's a bleak situation. Like, where do you put that?
Yeah. I think that's, like, something that even before I started, I was thinking about just in my career, being in the emergency room, of you see a lot of stuff, a lot of societal stuff. I mean, I look at it as you connect the community to the hospital. And so, there's going to be days where there's just a lot of heavy stuff. I mean, I remember when I was a student, I had a patient who, you know, didn't really have anything medically wrong with her, but she didn't want to go home because home was not safe, because every day somebody's dying on her block. So, you know, it's like we're not just dealing with medical problems, we're also like kind of dealing with everyday stuff. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden you're a psychologist.
Yeah, therapist, you know, relationship counselor, all of the above. Yeah.
What, so to my original question, like, when you witness trauma and there is death and everything like that, like, you know, when I was working for the news, I saw a lot of stuff too, but I just kind of tried to keep work at work. And then when I got home, it was like out of my mind. And I just kind of tried to be professional, I guess, about like storytelling, even if it's this like really emotional situation. So I guess I just kind of did it like as a compartmentalized my mind.
Yeah.
How do you handle the like intense emotion and a kind of heartbreak that's inherent in your work?
Yeah, I think I thought I was good at compartmentalizing, but I think when it is being from Chicago and being Black, I think when it is my community and my people, it's really hard to compartmentalize that. And those are the people I tend to take home with me more than anybody. Yeah. So I'm still like trying to navigate that as well. Yeah.
What part of the city did you grow up?
I grew up on the west side, like North Avenue and almost Oak Park. pretty much like North Avenue, so, Austin. Yeah.
Austin neighborhood then?
Yeah.
And it gets pretty rough over there.
Yeah.
Austin is one of the rougher neighborhoods in Chicago. And it's gotten a little bit better since last year, at least statistically speaking. But according to the Chicago Tribune, between mid-July and mid-August, there were nearly 5 violent crime reports per day in Austin. And that includes 5 homicides.
Is there any correlation between what you're doing now and the things you witnessed in that neighborhood?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so.
How so?
I don't know. I think that, like, I feel a very strong connection to Chicago that I don't think I felt when I lived there. I mean, I moved out of the city when I was 18. I went to college all the way in California, so I kind of, like, left. I didn't want to do anything with Chicago. But, you know, when you leave something, you remember how much, like, it was a part of you. And I don't know. I think this city is going through a lot, and I think that the neighborhoods that I've lived in and just the people I know who've grown up here too have been through a lot of change. I just feel like I couldn't turn my back on my people and just the city. So, like, I came back and I did it through medicine. I think had I been into something else, I probably would have still come back and done it through a different path. Yeah.
And then, you know, it's one of those things we don't report in the news, or when I was in the local mainstream, we didn't really report, like, on demographics and everything like that. But give me an idea of, when you're talking about your people and this overnight shift, like, is it overwhelmingly Black people, like, when it comes to those shootings and the trauma situations that you're dealing with overnight?
It depends. So, fortunately, too, my program, we work at many different hospitals in different neighborhoods. So, it really depends on what neighborhood and what hospital I'm at. But overall, it's not a particular race, per se. I just think because I am from Black community, I try to be present with all of my patients, but I think there's something about like older Black women who remind me of my mother or my grandmother. There's something about like Black men that remind me of like my father or my cousin. So, you know, there's like kind of like that personal connection that I just can't disconnect.
Okay, our extreme jobs episode will roll on in just a moment. We've tackled air and we've tackled land. Coming up, a man from overseas who has braved the seas for his job.
Any weather we got, we went out. So we were really crazy, even on risking things. So we like this kind of danger and crazy, really strong winds.
That conversation in just a moment, but first I need to pause really quickly to tell you about a couple of the sponsors that are making it possible for me to bring you Backseat Rider for free each week, one of which is TrueCar, which I would highly recommend if you are in the market for a new or a used car right now. A lot of people don't realize you can use TrueCar to buy a used car as well. Same benefit, the service lets you see what other people paid for the same car that you are looking for. That way, you go into the dealership with confidence. You don't have to worry that you're going to get taken advantage of or overpay for the car. You will see what other people wound up paying for that same vehicle, so you have all the information you need. Plus, get this, TrueCar users wind up saving on average $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or a used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Here at Podcast One, we love hearing from you. We read every tweet and comment you send our way. So don't miss your chance to take our summer listener survey. Just go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner, or go to podcastone.com/my survey. It only takes a few minutes and it gives you the opportunity to make a direct impact on your favorite shows. Tell us how you really feel so we can get to know you better. We value your thoughts and participation. So check out the survey at podcastone.com/my survey, or click on the survey banner on podcast1.com.
Hey everybody, another TV show to hype, and this one is a docuseries on A&E. I'm guessing that you've already heard some buzz about it. It is called Leah Remini, Scientology and the Aftermath. Season one was a hit. It got nominated for an Emmy, and season two is underway right now on A&E with 10 all-new episodes. And this series delves deep into some shocking accounts of abuse, heartbreak, and harassment that some of the people who have left the Church of Scientology say that they have experienced and decided to speak publicly about. So tune in to season two of Leah Remini, Scientology and the Aftermath, Tuesdays, 9, 8 Central on A&E. You can also catch up on any missed episodes on the A&E app or on aetv.com. Middle of a sunny weekday, I got a ride request from Old Town, and that's a pretty fancy neighborhood on the near north side of Chicago. As the name of the neighborhood would indicate, the houses and most of the apartment buildings in Old Town, they're really old, which makes them really valuable, very picturesque. If you've ever been to Georgetown in Washington, D.C., it kind of looks like that, kind of reminds me of Georgetown. So I pull up to a house on one of those quintessentially Old Town blocks, and I see this svelte middle-aged guy walking toward my car. He's carrying luggage. And when he started talking, I immediately knew that he was German. He'd been in Chicago visiting family and was heading to the international terminal at O'Hare. He was on his way back home. Now, he runs an art center day to day, but his path to do that started in a very unlikely place.
I learned boat building, so wooden boat building.
Wow.
Which is in Germany, it's a real profession. You learn, you take 3 years, you make exams, so it's a bit like study. You paint boats, you have to design it, you have to build them out of wood, steel, and actually even carbon and all these different materials.
Not just any boats. We're talking about boats that are nearly 100 feet long and built in what he called the traditional way, using techniques that have been used for hundreds of years.
Because this is a very, very old traditional, like 300-400-year-old techniques we learned there. So it's like really our ancient, the people who came to the States, they did the same technique how to build a boat to go over the ocean. Exactly the same. I saw some materials here, even here in Chicago, how they built here, because they have even a very nice tradition here. And I saw the same tools, how we did use it. So it was actually my idea. When I started boat building, I thought it's a profession I can do all over the world. And it's right. I found people in Brazil, in Chile, all over the world, and in Thailand, where they have similar techniques how to build a boat.
What makes you passionate about boat building? Why did you choose that, of all things, as a career?
It was by chance, actually. A friend of mine, I visited a friend of mine by chance on the seaside, because I wanted to have, was after my school, actually my high school.
And this is when you were how old, like 17, 18 years
old?
Yeah,
exactly. And I visited him, and then I saw, he was looking, he was living in a trailer, and I said, oh, you can't live in a trailer in the winter, it's too cold. You need a place. And I was there with another friend. Let's look, maybe we can find you something. So we went around on the countryside, it was really far in the northern part of Germany, And we found in one day a big house, a beautiful one, very, very inexpensive. So, oh, it's great. There are 3 rooms. Oh, you should come with us. Just stay with us for half a year and have a job. And so I really did it very spontaneously, get rid of home and want to go out, and it was great. So I found a job. I make pizza, you know.
Yeah.
So, like you are driving now, I did the same thing.
You drove a cab?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then there were 3 options for me. What can you do on a seaside where it's nothing? It's nothing. It's beautiful, but it's nothing. So you can become fisherman, you can go sailmaker, or boat builder.
Oh.
So these were the three options. And then my friend, he already started this career as a boat builder, and I went to see what he's doing. And if you go in a place like that, and I am really keen to know more here in the States about them, but it's so fascinating. You know, you come in and you see this kind of fish, you know, it's like a fish, a big fish, 30 meters long, wood like that, you know, it's really the trees, you know, hundreds of trees are in that, so strong, so powerful. And I thought, wow, how can you build a boat like that? How does it work? And it's so real. And I didn't want to make this abstract thing. And I thought, no, I don't want to sit behind a table now. I want to do real things. So it was so real. because you can go on a boat. You can, and then, I had a boat. We were sailing all the day. So it was, everything was connected to boats. So it's a very kind of holistic idea of doing something, and I found it super interesting. And it's a lot of mathematics is involved in that, physics is involved in that. So you really learn how to calculate a boat, you know, where you put the machine, where you put the weights on a boat, and in order to get it run very well, and how you calculate a wave, and all these things. So it's a very, very complex profession in a way. It's not just, you're not building a window, you know. It's always three-dimensional, it's turned around in many directions, and it has to follow the wind and several waves, and water is always different. Every boat should be in a way different, you know. In Lake Michigan you have completely other needs than on the ocean, and so on. So all these I found extremely interesting.
And you were building boats not for freshwater, but for ocean.
This
for
was
saltwater.
Yeah, right.
And when you say seaside, is there a seaside to Germany?
Yeah, yeah. There is a North Sea, which is nearly the Atlantic, but it's called North Sea. It's directly facing the Atlantic. And then there is a East Sea, which is more. This is a bit like Lake Michigan, but it's salty, but it's nearly closed. There's just a little opening in the seaside. And the East Sea is connected to Scandinavia, so Finland, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden.
That part of Germany is really remote, and he says that because it's so remote, the boating community is really tight, and that meant that everybody looked out for everybody else when it came to being on the water.
So we as kind of community of the mostly boat builder and friends of us, we went out very regularly in the sea, nearly every Sunday, every Saturday, sometimes during the week. And we went in any weather we got, we went out. So we were really crazy, even on risking things. So we liked this kind of danger and gray sea and really strong winds. And it happened. It was really several times that there were young, not very experts going with their little boats outside and getting completely lost. The sails were stripped off and they were alone and crying and whatever. So, and we had even a sailing boat, so it was not with motor. It was mostly we have a little motor, but it was not. So we had to find a way how to rescue them. And anyway, it's even a kind of dangerous thing, you know, the sea is. It's dangerous with somebody close to you, even if you think, oh, it's very easy to do it when the boat is moving. And so we got a certain kind of practice as a rescue people. And then I was interested in that, and I went out with professional rescue. That bit probably was one of the most exciting. I went out with one of these. There was a possibility to become a volunteer, and so I asked them, volunteer on rescue boats, but these are really big ones, like 70 meters long with 10,000
tons.
Very big machines. really amazingly. These are boats. These are ships which can turn around. They will never go down. They have two things, so you can damage them on many sides, and they're not able. It's nearly impossible that they are losing people. So a friend of mine who has lost his uncle, who was a captain on one of these boats, because they can turn. They turn all the time. So whatever the wind is, these boats will never go down. But if you are rescuing and you are outside, it can happen. The boat is just turning around on 180 degrees several times.
Now, when he says turning around 180 degrees, he means rocking side to side 180 degrees, making it very difficult to even stay in the boat if you're on one of the outside decks.
And they lost all the people on the boat. So I went out with one of
these. People would fall out?
Yeah, they fall out because they help somebody. And even if you're, it can happen even that it's so strong and you are not really heavily tied somewhere that you push against something and then you break your head or whatever. So they were all dead. But the boat was in perfect conditions.
Uh-huh.
Nothing happened. And I was one of these, and on these boats for like several times, so for 3 days, and we went out and in and out and in. And it was super exciting because it's such an amazing work they are doing. It's so dangerous and it's so courageous, and they are rescuing continuously people. Mostly surfer, you know, they went out too far. They're not able to come back anymore because they lose their power. And so surfer are very often rescued, but even little boats, so it's a bit like we have done. So I was a bit in that. I like this excitement on dangerous seasides.
What is it about you that wants to pursue that kind of danger? What is it about your personality? You got a family, you know. what is it, or what was it about your personality that made you want to get into those situations?
I think it's, I don't know if you know it as well, probably, you know, to come on the borders of what you can do, try out where what's really dangerous and to go over it and get this kind of, it's a way of excitement, but even you grow on that and you get more sure and maybe you're more prepared. Maybe it's even this kind of knowledge, I want to be prepared if something happens to me or somebody I know. And yeah, maybe it's a Christian thing to be prepared for something which you don't know. So in a way, it's even a way of controlling, can be. Because in a way, it's open, but on the other way, you want to control something which is heavier and stronger and more dangerous than you can imagine. And it's probably the same way how we are preparing constantly on resilience, in a way. You know? It's a kind of idea of to be resilient to the uncertainty. That's one. And I really experience how extremely dangerous the nature is and how wonderful it is, but how well we have to be prepared, and even how I think, yeah, even to honor it, especially the sea, or even in the desert. I experience in the States, the desert is a bit similar, like the ocean. So you underestimate very easily. You go there and think, ah, look here, it's beautiful. And, wow, you can get so fucked up in these kind of surroundings. And I think you have this long tradition, you know, all our populations all over the world, they prepared themselves for many, many, many years. They know all these techniques. People who are close to the seaside, they know it. But we are now mostly people from urban surroundings. We have no clue at all. Yeah, I don't know how's your background, but probably if you're growing up closer to the nature, you know how much you have to respect it. The snakes in the desert and all these kind of things. So if you go like somebody, just so it's not only about excitement, but it's even about Yeah, I can really enjoy it, but I have to. It's not just a touristic thing, you know. It's you have to handle it, and maybe it's about handling.
So, through that, you have pushed yourself beyond the limits of what normal people, or other people, or urban people have experienced, and through that, you feel like you gain a better understanding of what it is to be a human on this earth?
Yeah, I think so. It's very nicely described, I think. I think, because we are, you know, it's even creating a respect, you know. You know, how small we are and, you know, what we can do. How our interventions are so little, in a way. So we are destroying the world, but it's really not what nature deserves. So the nature does not need us. Absolutely not. And if we are going to ruin or destroy it, the nature will survive. If we are destroying the world in 50 years, something like this, the nature would just need not so much, especially the insects, or to recover everything. And so they don't need us. The nature does not need human beings at all, and it's much stronger.
It was great to meet a set of people who are doing or who have done jobs that I would never in a million years be capable of. Glad to know that there are people out there in the world that are willing to step up and go where a lot of us would never. And if you want to see what all three of these folks look like, you can check them out on my Instagram. I'm at Anthony Ponce TV. Last name is spelled P-O-N-C-E. Or you can check them out on Facebook as well. I'm at Anthony Ponce. All right, folks, that is going to do it for me for this week. I really hope you enjoyed hearing from these extreme workers as much as I did. It's kind of crazy that they all ended up in my car on the very same week. One last quick reminder to please sign up for Lyft using my promo code BACKSEATRIDER, all one word. Again, it's for new users of the Lyft app, and that code is good for up to $50 in free ride credit, and using it also really helps me keep this podcast going. Also, please join up with us in the Backseat Rider community group on Facebook. All you have to do is search Facebook groups for Backseat Rider. You'll find it. A moderator will approve you. And it's a great place to discuss this or any other episode of Backseat Rider. All the relevant links are in the show notes for your convenience. Backseat Rider is edited by Bob Gil Martin and produced by me with the help of Louis Kazmarek. Also, thank you so much to WTTW and WTTW.com for their support of this podcast. Look for new episodes of Backseat Rider every Wednesday on PodcastOne.com, the all-new Podcast One app, which is available in the App Store and Google Play. It's got all kinds of new features on it. And of course, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. I'll see everybody next Wednesday. Backseat Rider.